This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. In more than 50 film roles, my guest, actor and comedian John Leguizamo, has played a drag queen, a boxer, a Navy SEAL, a Latino gangster, and a zombie. But now he's taken on something new, a Spanish-speaking role. Leguizamo, who was born in Colombia and raised in New York, stars in the new movie Crónicas, produced by Alfonso Cuarón, who directed the widely acclaimed Y Tu Mama También. In addition to his film work, Leguizamo has built a devoted following for his stand-up comedy and one-man shows, which draw heavily on his childhood in ethnically rich neighborhoods in New York. In a review of his show, Freak, which earned 2 Tony nominations, the New York Times' Ben Brantley said that when Leguizamo inhabits characters from his past, it seems less an act of impersonation than an instance of possession. There's a whole city of people inside this young man's slender frame. We'll hear clips from some of those performances later in the show. John Leguizamo's films include Summer of Sam, Romeo and Juliet, and Moulin Rouge. Recently, he appeared in The Honeymooners and the zombie flick Land of the Dead. In Crónicas, which opens across the country Friday, Leguizamo plays a reporter for a Spanish-language TV show pursuing an Ecuadorian serial killer. John Leguizamo, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, great to be back. I love NPR and Fresh Air.
You've been performing a long, long time in English, doing a lot of Latino characters.
Yeah, not Spanish.
Yeah, was it hard to act in Spanish for you?
Oh, yeah. It was one of the hardest things I had to do. I mean, I was born in Latin America. I was born in Colombia. I came here when I was 3. And my parents spoke Spanish at the house, but I spoke English back. So this was a punishment because I regret I didn't speak back to them in Spanish because I wasn't as fluid or as free. Luckily, it worked right into my character that I was creating, because this character I was creating was a journalist, very ambitious, very controlling.
Who lives in Miami, right?
Lives in Miami.
Right.
Who navigates between, you know, and people in Miami, those journalists over there, they navigate between Spanish and English so easily and fluent in both and you know, very articulate in both. And so I want to represent that as well.
You've played so many different roles as an actor, and you've studied acting. But I'm wondering if you had a situation here where part of your brain had to concentrate on just getting the language right, and if it made it harder to just sort of let that, you know, that spirit that gets unleashed in your performances thrive.
No, that was it. You hit it right the nail on the head, man. That's exactly what happened. I mean, I definitely had to focus much more on language, and. I mean, the character was a very reactive character, which was a challenge for me as well. I mean, it wasn't just the Spanish. It was also, this guy was very reactive. And I'd usually pick roles which are much more, you know, proactive. And, you know, they're scene stealers. And, you know, it's built into the script that this part is going to rock. You know, and this one was different. He was very contained.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. Part of my brain did spend a lot of time. I mean, I had to spend, like, weeks memorizing the dialogue in advance, which I never do. I always, like, learn my dialogue the morning of. And I had to get a tutor and a coach, you know, and every time I improvised, the director yelled, cut, because my Spanish was, you know, it was kind of, I have a third grade vocabulary and grammar, you know, and grammar might be even less. You know, I sound like me want interview you come here, you know.
Wouldn't cut it for Latino audiences.
No, I mean, right, I was supposed to be a college graduate, really bright journalist, really ambitious, not talking, you know, poder hablar español, gracias. Wasn't going to cut it.
It is an absorbing story. It involves you playing a reporter for a tabloid Latino television network based in Miami, yeah. And you go to Ecuador to investigate a horrible set of serial killings by someone who's killing children, and get involved in a very morally complex situation there.
What I loved about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask how you prepared for that. Well, did you tag along with, say, a tabloid TV reporter? How did you get into that mindset?
Well, the movie's based on a true serial killer who has the ridiculous, dubious honor of being in the World Book of Guinness for most killings. I mean, he killed 194, 93, something like that, kids. And he got away with it in Latin America because he went from poor town to poor town and crossed borders, went to Ecuador. And he got away and then came back to Colombia, cops don't care, and unless it's in a rich neighborhood, and if somebody from a wealthy family gets, you know, becomes a victim, then they'll concern themselves. And what I did was I read up on all that stuff. There was a lot of documentary footage on this serial killer. His name was Garavito. And so I saw a lot of stuff on him. And then I did go with a small television crew in Ecuador for 2 weeks at 6 a.m. I went to the morgue. And, you know, I saw my first autopsies in the morning. And then the parents would come in to identify the body. And then we'd go to the scene of the crime or to the police precinct to see if there were any suspects or any clues. And then at 7 o'clock or 6:30, we'd have a 30-second tape, you know, a 30-second segment. I did it for 2 weeks. And I got a whole new respect for reporters, man, because it was the toughest thing I ever had to do, especially dealing with the parents. It would break my heart every time.
What was hard about it, just grappling with it emotionally?
Yeah, you know, I mean, usually there were kids always under 20, died some horrible, you know, one kid was, his father had a taxi company and his son wouldn't be a lawyer, and his dad didn't have enough drivers, so his son volunteered that night before exams to drive the cab, and somebody tried to rob the cab, and he tried to fend the car for his dad, and he got shot. And the next day, the dad had to come and identify the body, and then I had to see the autopsy. It was just brutal stories that reporters have to live with and have to keep that in your psyche. It was devastating.
And without giving too much away, he gets involved in a situation where he has a suspicion about who the serial killer may be and has a chance to get a confession on tape. But to do that, he has to play a bit of a bargaining game and presents him with some tough moral choices. The film was shot on location in Ecuador, right?
Oh, yeah, strictly in Ecuador. Ecuador is beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful country. And we were in the poorest city in Ecuador, which was by a sort of reclaimed land that they built on stilts by this river that floods every year. And we shot there. And then at night, you know, I'd go to my fancy hotel in the richest section with, you know, bodyguards and everything. It was such a schizophrenic experience.
What do you think that being on location added to the film?
Well, these were the real people of the town who were the extras in the lynching sequence, which was based on some real footage. And they were in it, and they got into it, and, you know, the authenticity of being in this poor neighborhood. And I mean, the beautiful thing about this movie and a lot of Latin films is that there's a sociopolitical element in all of them that's a part of it, and I love that. I mean, it's not, you know, a propaganda film, and it's not getting on a soapbox or anything, but you feel tiny little comments, and you see sort of the disparity of the way they treat people. And And you know, Latin America, 10% are rich and everybody else eats crow, you know?
Right. I mean, something you just said, I hadn't quite realized. There was a scene early in the film where a man is driving a car and accidentally hits a child, and a crowd quickly gathers, pulls him from the car, and is about to, in effect, kind of beat and burn him to death. And very nearly accomplished it. You're saying this was done with people in the village participating?
All those extras weren't actors. There were people in the village, and it was tough to orchestrate, you know, because I mean, the people are very gentle, but you wanted them to be aggressive, so you had to get them into this, whip them up into this frenzy. But then, you know, you had to control, depict, you know, certain extras to be the ones who are actually going to manhandle us, and that's where it gets tricky. You know, you want it to be aggressive, but you don't want to get beat up either. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it was scary. Sometimes it was scary, and the people were so gentle, but you had to whip them up into like a crazy mob mentality. Which this whole scene was based on actual footage, which was brutal. You know, a whole town taking justice into their own hands because this man had, you know, raped and molested. And it's wild to see what a mob can do.
Right. And in this case, these people had to induce to attack celebrities, in effect, you and the other actors.
Right. But we warned him. I said, not the face. I have a future.
Well, you know, a lot of your fans know something about your upbringing from the one-man shows that you have written and performed over the years. Especially
too much, perhaps.
Yeah, well, maybe. One of them, called Freak, you've described as sort of what, semi-demi, quasi-autobiographical. You were born in Columbia. You grew up in Jackson Heights, right?
In New York City.
In Queens.
Yeah, Bridge and Tunnel.
Which was like a real ethnic mix. And were you a mimic as a kid? I mean, did you make your parents and your brother laugh?
Yeah, I mean, I was always trying to get laughs in the house because it was the only time I didn't get beatings. So I was always trying to be mad funny on the street, you know, in school, wherever I was. I mean, I was kind of a short guy. And I don't know why I got picked on a lot in school. I don't know why. I mean, my parents and I were broke. And you know how it is in ghetto schools. It's all about your sneakers that you have and the jeans, and they got to be the right brand. And if you have, like, the mad cheap, you know, generic pants and sneakers, you're going to get picked on it. So I got picked on a lot. And so it made me have to be funny to defend myself.
And how would that work? I mean, you'd just somebody about to pop you and you'd crack them up?
I would make them laugh, you know. Yeah, exactly. I'd have to make the class laugh and laugh at the other guy and, you know, put him down. And, you know, sometimes I had to throw down. I had to fight because there's a point where laughter is not going to defend you. You better have some fisticuffs.
So you did some of that, too. We see some members of your family, and I wanted to play one cut here. You're reenacting both sides of a conversation with your father, who in this case has sort of gotten is drinking a bit and is sort of sharing some of his philosophy with you. And again, this is my guest John Leguizamo from the One Man Show Freak, and he is playing both himself and his father in this.
You're so lucky to have a dad like me. When I could be out there just f***ing some hot stinking women. Oh yeah, but am I doing that? No, because I'm here spending quality time. Come on, puppy, I'll give you a shot. Come on. Oh, it's happy juice. Come on.
No, Dad. It tastes like dookie.
Why don't you just quit drinking, Dad? Because I'm not a quitter.
That was my guest, John Leguizamo, from the one-man show, Freak. It's still funny, isn't it?
You mind if I laugh at myself?
Go ahead. How close is that to your dad? You know, it's interesting. He says he's not a quitter. I mean, he was a guy of ambition, but if this is to be believed, he was really tough on you and your mom. They split up when you were 13, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I took artistic license with my dad. But I mean, it's based on two elements. You know, my dad was great when he was drunk. He was the friendliest he ever was. And the other times he was a mean son of a bitch. You know, that's the way he was. He was very ambitious and he liked the ladies and whatnot. And, you know, but when he drank, he was like friendly and fun. You could goof with him and all that. So those are the best times I had with my dad.
Now, I read that you, at some point when you were a kid, you were sent back to Colombia to live for a while. What led to that?
Well, I was sent back when I was 14 because I was running with a crew that was kind of tough, and I gotten arrested and whatnot, and I was with a rough crowd, you know, and my mom knew that, you know, I was, you know, hormones had kicked, I was becoming really popular in school, and I had a lot of opportunities, you know, I was very popular, and I liked the girls and whatnot, and so they sent me to Colombia to pull me away from all this and to separate me from that, and you know, I hated them at the time, but it worked. You know, it did save me. When I came back, I was pulled away from that crowd, and I couldn't get back in.
What were you arrested for?
Oh, silly, ridiculous things. I got arrested for breaking into the IRT number 7 train and grabbing the mic, the conductor's mic, you know, rapping on it. I got arrested for, you know,
You were arrested for performing on a subway.
Yes. It was my first bad review, I guess, right? I got arrested because I jumped a turnstile, but I didn't get arrested for that. I got arrested for mouthing off at the cop. I got arrested for truancy.
Right, right.
Who gets arrested for truancy? I mean, that's so our gang, isn't it? Like,
right, would that ever happen
Spanky.
Today?
What are you doing outside of school? Oh, I'm going to take you in. I'm going to run you in.
And what was the experience like being in Colombia? Was it just a break from bad
habits? I was
depressed. Yeah.
Yeah, I was depressed because I was, you know, I was like, I was the man here in New York City. I was having such a great time. And all of a sudden, you know, the language was a shock. And I was in this, you know, and they put me in this like really wealthy school with all these rich socialites. And that, you know, it was a big cultural shock for me in terms of language. And you know, these kids had money and I came from not having money. So it was all very strange and weird. And, you know, it was a lonely time for me. But it, you know, made me solid. I played a lot of basketball.
You come back, and what got you into to performing seriously? not just goofing off with your friends.
Well, you know, it was. I think you always have to have intervention, and I think you always have to have a mentor, especially when you're somebody like myself. I mean, I was able to make people laugh, and I was funny, but I was also disruptive. And this math teacher, Mr. Zufa, whose name rhymes with loofah, said to me, John, why don't you stop, wasting your life and your time? Why don't you become a comedian or an actor? Why don't you do that with your life instead of, you know, just disrupting my class? And, you know, I was a punk, and I said, you know, F you. But I went home, and I listened to him, and I looked in the yellow pages, and I found an acting school. And I started going to acting classes. And from there, you know, I found myself. I did this one scene about this troubled youth who was in therapy and all this. And I hit the zone. I got all these offers to be in NYU movies, and I hit this zen moment in my life, this zone where I felt, this is what I want to do, this is what I can do.
A lot of your material you developed from, you know, your experiences in the neighborhood and with your family. And one thing that I was curious about, you know, your parents broke up when you were 13, and at the end of your stage show, The Freak, I mean, you reenact a pretty tough fight between your mom and dad. I mean, there's some pretty painful family stuff here. It's very funny, but, you know, but it's real stuff. And I'm curious what mom and dad thought when they saw their lives in your one-man show.
Oh, they weren't happy at all. My parents were so – they were devastated. I mean – and the funny thing is that they don't see themselves in there, and they don't see – they think I'm making it up. And I was like, these are actual words that I recalled my whole life with that big fight between my parents. It was kind of brutal. Those were actual words. I didn't really add too much to that beat. You know what I mean? I added, you know, some humor here and there on the sides, sort of like to, you know, balance it out. But a lot of those words were you know, verbatim. And they were just devastated. And then, you know, then they start to admit that, you know, maybe, you know, they weren't the best parents. And when I heard that, I was very happy. I like to hear a confession. It's what I wanted. And I got, you know, it was tough at first, but then we got closer and, you know, now we're not so close anymore.
Yeah. Oh, really? They're not so much anymore?
Yeah, you know, it's these shows, which were sort of a cleansing and a purge for me, weren't such a purge for them. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They need to get their own purge. They need their own therapy.
You were estranged from your dad for a lot of years, right? And then
the show, he came to the show like after it had been running for a while, and he was in my dressing room, and he was just, I was saying hello to Mike Myers and whatnot, and then I see this seething face in the corner, and it's my dad. And
how long had it been since
goes, you,
how long had it been like, since you'd seen him when that happened?
About 3 years.
Wow.
And then, you know, we ran into the alley, and, you know, I cursed him out, and, you know, I told him all the things that, you know, I should have said that I never said. And we got really close for a while. But, you know, it's this material. The problem is when you put material like this out there as so public, it lives on. You know, they constantly play it on HBO, and they constantly play it everywhere, you know. And all of a sudden my parents have to hear it, and their friends call them up. And, you know, it opens up wounds constantly. You know, that's the problem with that.
Right. The revelation is one thing, but the repetition is another.
Repetition wears down, you know, wears down the family unit a bit, you know. But I'll get close to them again. There's phases. We go through phases, but it's the fact that it lives on in perpetuity that's going to always be I always constantly have to apologize, constantly have to make up.
Well, I want to play another piece from Sexaholic, A Love Story. The one I wanted to play here was where you recount the beginning of the relationship with Teenie, who is now your wife.
Oh, right. Yes.
And she is sort of, this is a whole different kind of relationship for you, and she's kind of laying down some rules about how she looks at life and relationships.
Okay, John, before you get serious, let me tell you all about myself, okay? I'm very practical, okay? I'm a Jew. And I don't want anything from you that I can't give back to you, okay? Because I've worked hard on myself, so you don't have to. I just want you to be there for me sometimes when I need you, and then we're golden, okay? So let's play it by ear. Whatever happens, happens. Okay, have fun. Go. And I applauded too, because she was amazing. And I didn't want to mess this up, so I was really hard on myself to mature. So when my therapist said, "Congratulations, John, you are now emotionally 12 years old." 13, here we come.
And all three voices there are my guest, John Leguizamo, from his one-man show, Sexaholic, A Love Story. You know, the reason I wanted to play that, apart from the fact that it's funny, is you talking to a therapist. And I read somewhere once that you had you once had to quit therapy because it was ruining your comedy. Is that right?
Right. I mean, I went to therapy, I guess, since I was 17 till I was about 21, and because the school, the high school required it, otherwise it wouldn't let me back in. And, yeah, you know, I was a class clown, and I was, you know, I constantly needed attention. You know, I was like a, you know, like a bottomless pit of attention. And therapy sort of healed me, and it took away all that, and all of a sudden I wasn't being as funny. I didn't have the desire, you know. I was normal, you know what I mean? So it was very weird to be normal and not be funny anymore. I kind of miss my old self, which is now I see it helps me because, you know, I have control. I have an on and off switch.
Right. I mean, you are a lot kind of more stable now, I think. And you're still funny, right?
Well, I'm stable. I'm funny when I get paid, yeah.
You've been acting now for over 20 years. And apart from the comedy stage shows you've done lots and lots of movies. You've played everything from a boxer to a drag queen to a Navy SEAL, but you've spoken out recently about the kinds of roles that Hollywood tends to offer Latino actors, right? I mean, there's a problem here.
Yeah, but you know what? I was misquoted. It was at a Latin Hispanic conference,
right?
And I was misquoted because what I said things are. They said I think they said that I said that the roles are very stereotypical or something like that.
Right.
And that's not what I said. I mean, I said it used to be when I was
okay
young. Auditioning, you know, it was, you know, me and Benjamin Brad and me and Louis Guzman and Benicio del Toro. We had to be gang members or you know, drug dealers or on the service side. You know, we had to be gardeners or you know, some kind of servant type role. But things have really changed, and there's huge progress in terms of Hollywood finding that Latin market. They're so wanting it, and they're so primed for it. They just have to figure out how to crack it. What I did say was, though, that Hollywood hasn't found those Latin stories. They don't know how to put those stories up there, and they don't know how to find them, and they haven't figured them out. They're all every movie they throw out there saying it's for Latin people, it's really a horrible, whitewashed piece of garbage that nobody would see, even if it was white people or anybody. They were just really bad stories.
Well, when you started, I mean, one of your breaks was a role on the TV series Miami Vice, in which you played, I believe, the son of a drug lord.
Yes, of course.
When was it in your career that people began to see you as an actor rather than as a guy who ought to be, you know, in a role sticking up a liquor store?
Well, it was because I said I had enough with those Hollywood-type roles, and I started writing my own stuff because it was just very disappointing and demeaning, you know. Here I was, you know, in my early 20s, and I'd gone to college, I tried to improve myself, and everything that was thrown at me was so degrading and unbelievably demeaning that I was like, forget that. I'm going to create my own stuff and perform it for myself and whoever wants to listen. And I wrote Mumble Mouth, you know, and from there, you know, all of a sudden, I didn't even have a real theater. I was in the hallway of a theater, and I had to pick up my stage before the main show at 9 o'clock. And you know, and I got these reviews in the New York Times and everywhere, and all of a sudden, you know, John F. Kennedy Jr. is there, and Raul Julia, and Arthur Miller, Sam Shepard. I mean, it was incredible.
This is from Mambo Mouth.
I couldn't believe it. Yeah.
Which was the first of these one-man shows you did,
yeah.
Which got more and more successful, and you were nominated for a Tony, right, for The Freak, I believe.
Not for
right?
that one. For Freak. Yeah, for Freak I got nominated
right.
for two Tonys, I think.
Right, right. A couple of interesting, really interesting roles. I think a lot of people who watch Hollywood movies may know you from the film, which has one of the strangest titles I've ever heard, To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, in which you and Patrick Swayze and Wesley Snipes are dressing up in drag and going on a road trip. What a part. I mean, how did you prepare for that?
Well, I had talked to a lot of transvestites. And the studio helped me get this sort of like coach, is it Larissa Dumont? I can't remember what his real name was, but you know she walked me through the paces, and I tried to take as much of her accent and some of her words. You know, she was amazing, and she gave everything she was. I put in that character of Chichi Rodriguez for the movie.
And what was it like working with Patrick Swayze and Wesley Snipes, who were, of course, gorgeous, dressed up as gorgeous women the whole time, too? I mean, were you guys
trying to be gorgeous,
competing for who was the cutest?
Oh, it wasn't a competition. Unfortunately, it was a slaughter because, I mean, I was the youngest of all of them, so, you know, and I looked the best. Plus, you know, I mean, I really took it more seriously, I think. I mean, I became a vegetarian for a couple months, so, and no protein, so my muscle would dissolve, you know, so I would be like, you know, like ripe fruit.
Really? Wow.
So, yeah, I tried to look like more like a drag queen, and because drag queens don't have muscles, you know, so I had to try to lose all the muscle I had.
Yeah, well, it works. I mean, my wife and I watched that film, and I said, you know, I would date this guy. I mean, you really did look good.
I get a lot of letters from prison. I'm serious. I had to move my address because I got a lot of letters from jail. I love that movie. I'm like, I'm scared of that. I'm never going to do anything against the law because I know where I'm going to end up being.
Right, right. I mean, the other thing I wondered is, you know, the whole movie is about deception. I mean, these people are going out as men pretending to be women, you know, and then here you are, straight men pretending to be gay men, pretending to be women. Was it just a little weird at times?
It was weird. I mean, at first it was hilarious. You were all cracking up and laughing, but it got weird. It was a strange thing. I mean, here we are, you know, in Nebraska and with three dudes and constantly wearing dresses and, you know, and things to hide our genitalia and being waxed and all. It was just bizarre. It got annoying after a while. And then me and Wesley would go out and, you know, shoot guns and do manly stuff to reaffirm our masculinity.
Another memorable role for you was the lead in Summer of Sam, which was the Spike Lee film.
Oh, I had a great time on that.
Yeah. Now, for folks that may not have seen it, I mean, here you're finally breaking out of the Latino mold and you get to play an Italian guy, decidedly ethnic, in a Brooklyn neighborhood who hangs out with a bunch of tough guys and cheats on his wife, and his life kind of spirals out of control while the son of Sam, serial killer, stalks New York. Tell us about getting into that role.
Well, Spike had directed Freak for HBO.
Right.
And we had such a great time together, and he had this script that he was working on called Summer of Sam, and he offered me this part of Vinny. And I thought it was amazing piece. I mean, it was such a study of what happens in these closed-minded communities that are kind of very insular, and they sort of start, you know, serving as their own justice, and they have their own laws and codes, and the writer of the piece, it was about his life, you know, Victor Colicchio, and so I hung out with him. I spent a lot of time with him. I thought, you know, the best way to get this part is to hang out with him, and try to be as much him without, you know, he's got a very strong accent. He talks a lot like this here, you know. He's like really got a really thick accent there, and I didn't want to really cartoonize him, so I definitely pull back on that. I just put a little flavor and a little spin on it.
You know, it sounds like you invested an awful lot of time in preparing for that role. I mean, did that reflect kind of a point in your career where what you wanted to do were things that were interesting and challenging and different, whether or not they were big or lucrative?
Yeah, definitely that marked the point where I realized research was the answer to finding a character for me. Research is everything for me. And really walking in somebody else's shoes. And it was, you know, it was a testament that independent films are really about character, and they really, you know, cater to a character. And I love that about independent films. So, you know, I try to do, you know, my Hollywood share films because you need that for your career, and sometimes they're good. But the independent films are the ones that I feel like an artist. You know, I feel like this is what I really felt when I was 17 in that class, you know, when I first felt that zone, you know, being in the zone.
Right. You've described yourself as a method actor. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm totally method actor. I mean, I have to do research. I have to feel the part. I have to be in it emotionally.
Right, and there's a story which I think is probably doctored a bit in one of your monologues about an encounter with a legendary acting teacher, Lee Strasberg.
Not doctored as much as you think.
What actually happened?
I was in his class for one day, and I was doing sense memory in his class. He came up to me. He said that wasn't very good. He said, in his way he talked, he said, that wasn't very good. He had like a windpipe thing. He was kind of in his 70s or something. And he died that night. And that was the last I ever was in his class. And it was shocking and, you know.
A mortifying
performance.
My acting.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know, another criticism on my acting.
You said you were doing sense memory for him? Explain that. Explain that. What do you mean?
Oh, sense memory is, you know, a lot of method is based on sort of creating from your imagination sensorially, meaning using your five senses to create a reality that's not there. Kind of like what I guess what schizophrenic people do sort of normally and naturally. You try to create like a place or an object that meant a lot to you as a child or somebody, and you try to see them even though they're not there. You try to smell them, hear them, feel them. And, you know, that's helped me with my stage work immensely. When I'm doing those one-man shows, I try to see and feel and hear. And when it's working the best is I see them and hear, and I'm responding to stimuli that's there to me, that I believe to be there.
You know, the one-man shows that you do must take an awful lot out of you. I mean, they're just incredibly high energy and often emotionally intense. And I'm wondering, what's the pace of like that? Are you hard to live with when you're doing that every night, or does it you know, energize you?
Well, my wife's a saint. You know, she puts up with an incredible amount. I mean, being married to an actor is ridiculous. I don't recommend it to anybody. I mean, for Freak, I was silent for a year. I didn't talk at all. I couldn't because my throat was so hoarse and sore. So she learned sign language with me, and I would sign to her because it was faster than writing on a piece of paper.
Wait a minute. You mean that you saved your entire voice for the performance and tried to remain silent the rest of the time?
I had to. I couldn't. If I one day I did an interview or something, and I suffered that night. I lost my voice on stage for about 5 minutes, and I don't know if it was going to return. So I had to. I couldn't talk. First of all, it hurt so much that I didn't want to talk, and then I couldn't. I had to save it. And for a year, I didn't talk. You know, the whole year that I was doing the show, they got to the point it was too painful. And, you know, and it's about, I have to save myself. I have to do a lot of athleticism, too. I mean, I start running a lot, and I, you know, I quit smoking usually and you know, alcohol and all that, and I just got to get in the best shape possible because it's the Olympics.
Uh-huh. And are you going to keep doing them, these one-man shows?
You know, I want to do first some real theater. I want to do, not that my stuff isn't real, or theater, but
right. But
I really
want to
do like,
right.
But it is different. I want to do it with a real cast. You know, not one that from my imagination. I definitely want to do some real plays because I love theater. I think it's the best type of acting you can ever see. When it's good, when it's bad, it's the worst kind of acting you can see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I want to hear one more clip from Sexaholics. And this is a funny one where you're a dad now, and this is one where I guess you've been left alone with your son for the first time. Your wife has gone out with her daughter, and here you are caring for an infant. Let's listen to this.
Me and little man alone for the first time. That's cool. We'll watch TV, get pizza. Here, have a little beer. And the little prick gets colicky on me. And he screams these cries that make you want to rip out your ears. Ah! Holy shit, what the hell happened? I played with you. I fed you. Look, I know you can't talk, but what the f*** is going on? Ah! Ah! Then I started to think you was getting competitive with me. Oh, so you think you can take me, huh? I see how you're trying to take Teeny away from me. Every time you breastfeed, you put your little arm around it. Don't think I haven't noticed. And he gives me back the same shifty I grew up in New York City to mother look that I have. Oh, wait till you have kids. You'll see. I put a curse on you. Sofrito cuchipito que se joda un poquito.
That was my guest, John Leguizamo, from his one-man show, Sexaholics, A Love Story. That's you getting to know your son when he was an infant.
You're a dad.
Yeah. Kids are older now, and you're, you know, working a lot as an actor and raising these kids. And one of the things that interests me is you know, you grew up poor, but in a very, well, culturally rich community, and had to confront a lot of stuff from with a broken family and difficulties in you know, in the community. Your kids, I'm sure, have a much easier life, have you know, a lot, they're, you know, it's probably more comfortable.
Too easy.
Yeah, comfortable, more affluent, you know, probably not as urban. And I'm wondering, do you ever wish that you could give your kids in a safe way some of the experience that you had?
Absolutely. You know, you want to prepare them for life, and you want them to be, I don't want them to be brats, and I want them to be spoiled. Definitely don't want that, you know, and I want them to be open-minded and be able to, you know, flow from one ethnic group to the other and from one economic class to the other. But who knows, you know, it's really tough to be able to give them all that. You know, I try, but it's hard. You know, you put them in a private school, really expensive, everybody's mad rich and, you know, mostly white, and it gets very privileged and very, you know, homogenous. So it's hard, you know, I try. I hopefully they'll be responsible and they'll be able to give back. I mean, I definitely want them to be like activists, and I want them to be political in some kind of way that's powerful and gives back to, you know, to all these people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in your earlier stage shows, I mean, in Mambo Mouth, I mean, it was based, as I recollect, on seven characters. And one of them was a guy named Giacomoto, who is a Hispanic guy who appears to be Japanese and is there to show Hispanic people how they cannot seem Hispanic by seeming Japanese. And it sounds like a very funny bit. And you were accused of reinforcing a lot of ethnic stereotypes. And, you know, one of your shows was called Spikorama, and you used that kind of terminology. And I'm wondering how you reacted then to this idea that you were reinforcing stereotypes, and whether you feel at all differently about it with some age.
Well, they were wrong. I mean, they were wrong. They were wrong. I thought they were wrong back then. I still
and
think
they're
wrong.
Wrong.
And they're still wrong, even more so. I mean, the piece was attacking Latin self-hate. That's what I was attacking. It wasn't attacking, you know, anything else. And Giacomoto, this Japanese guy, you know, I had slides of you know, things that people mock us for, that we mock ourselves for, and it was attacking that. You know, some people walked out of the theater crying and whatnot, but it was attacking self-hate, and self-hate in Latin culture is very, oh, it's so built into our culture, it's so part of us, and it's a horrible thing, you know. And it's so hard for them to realize, you know, for a lot of people don't even realize that they think they're white, some people, and they forget that they have Indian and black in them, and it's very weird for me to, when I see these people, you know, with their faces like five shades lighter than their necks and you know, all that kind of stuff that happens.
Well, you know, you've done so much interesting roles recently. You were Toulouse-Lautrec in Moulin Rouge, and now you've done you've eaten dead bodies in Land of the Dead.
Land of the Dead, George Romero. Oh, that was great.
Yeah. Do you have a direction you want to go next? Do you know where you see yourself in 5 or 10 years?
I mean, I definitely am. You know, I always have some sort of a quest. I mean, there's a few roles that I want to play. I definitely want to play a cop. I haven't played a cop, and I want to do that, and a lawyer and a politician. So I'm questing for those kind of roles, and they're coming to me. What I really want to do is write a movie comedy, like I've done with my one-man shows. That's what I'm really wanting to do. Is like really, you know, smarter comedy than I see in America. American comedies to me are kind of dumb. And, I mean, the greatest comedy has been Annie Hall to me and, you know, Monty Python. So if I could just, you know, strive for that kind of greatness, I'd be all right.
All right. And your wife will have to just put up with you, right?
Yeah, she signed on. You know, she knew what she was going to get into, poor woman.
Well, John Leguizamo, thanks so much for talking with us.
Dave, has been great.
Actor John Leguizamo. His new film, Chronicus, opens across the country Friday.